We're going to pray. Gracious God, you know, as we approach your throne in this time of worship, as we gather to remind each other of what we believe to be true, you know what we carry with us. You know the grief and the joy that we bring. You know the hope that we carry, no matter how small. We ask that you would make yourself known to us in this time together, that you might be visible and clear, not just in the words that we read or listen to or sing together, but in the faces of those around us. We love you, God. In the name of Jesus, we pray. Amen. This summer, we have been working through the teachings of Jesus, and we are nearing the end of that endeavor, but we are somewhat interrupted this week. Sometimes in the Christian calendar, because there have been many Christian calendars throughout the years that we've started this, we have two different days that we celebrate a particular event. So often we discuss the transfiguration of Jesus in the springtime, right before Lent starts, usually. But sometimes we celebrate it in the summer. There's another calendar that uses a date, ironically, today, August the 6th, to reflect on this major moment in Jesus's life and ministry. So we're going to talk about Jesus's transfiguration. So we're going to read from the text, Matthew chapter 17. We're going to do 1 through 12, even though the reading usually goes through 9, because it's my sermon. I can read as long as I'd like. 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and his brother John and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became bright as light. Suddenly there appeared to them Moses and Elijah talking with him. And Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will set up 3 tents here, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." While he was still speaking, suddenly a bright cloud overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my son, the beloved. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." When the disciples heard this, they fell to the ground and were overcome by fear. But Jesus came and touched them, saying, "Get up and do not be afraid." And when they raised their eyes, they saw no one except Jesus himself alone. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus ordered them, "Tell no one about the vision until after the Son of Man has been raised from the dead." And the disciples asked him, "Why then do the scribes say that Elijah must come first?" He replied, "Elijah is indeed coming and will restore all things, but I tell you that Elijah has already come." And they did not recognize him, but they did to him whatever they pleased. So also the Son of Man is about to suffer at their hands. In our story, we see 3 of the disciples go up to this mountain with Jesus. They are alone, as in the rest of the disciples and the followers of Jesus were not with them. It's just the 4 up the mountain. And while they are there, the text tells us that Jesus is transfigured, changed, his face shining like the sun, his clothes brighter than any light. Moses and Elijah, these crucial figures from the history of Israel, appear, even though they have been dead a very long time. Moses is the giver of the law to Israel. He is the one who led them out of Egypt into the promised land. Elijah is the ultimate prophet of Israel, one who spoke truth in challenging circumstances time and time again. Their presence here at this mountaintop means something. Between the divine glory of Jesus' clothes and countenance, and these 2 who represent God's covenant with Israel, even before the cloud comes in and God begins to speak, we already know that something is up. These elements combined together tell us that Jesus is no ordinary man, no regular teacher, no mere healer. But in fact, Jesus is divine, the Son of God, and the fullness of everything God had ever promised to Israel. Jesus is what these disciples were waiting for, even if they didn't know it, even if they didn't understand it. This story has a lot of different things we could draw from as we approach the text today. But we're going to focus on the role of the disciples and the character type they fulfill. And then we're going to take our lead from their work in the story. Matthew, like all writers, has specific angles that he interprets events through, a certain point that he's trying to make as he writes down these stories of Jesus. And it might change where he puts a story in the timeline or what kind of a word he repeats in a given section of the text. And in this story, Matthew is trying to make a comparison between the disciples and a certain kind of character from the writings of the history of Israel. And the time period where we're going to find this archetype is a time in the history of Israel that they spent in Persia, partially in exile, and then under Greek and Roman rule in Palestine. It's called the Second Temple period because during that time they built a second temple. It spanned maybe 500 years before Jesus through about 70 CE after Jesus has already died. And during this period, a lot of the work that was done in Jewish religious work was the writing and compiling of the stories and laws of Israel. They come from a culture that does a lot more speaking and listening than writing. But at this transition point for Israel, they do a lot of what we would call codifying. They're writing down and organizing the history and stories and law of Israel. Now, because we have read stories before, we know that there are often defining features for different kinds of characters or storylines. And the prophecies in the history of Israel are not different in that way. In these stories, there are people who really existed, but whose stories are told in such a way as to portray them in a given light, to give us as readers or listeners a hint about who they're supposed to be. We have this in English too, not just your classic, if you're starting a fairy tale, you begin with a variation of Once Upon a Time. But even in characters, if you meet a character in the story, and they're kind of suspicious, and they say to the protagonist, "Trust me," you know for sure you can't trust that guy. In a similar way, we see identifying markers in the story to tell us who these characters are supposed to be. Knowing this, we can learn that the role of the disciples in this story is that of an apocalyptic seer. I know, a bit of a ridiculous title, but we'll work through it. When I use the word apocalyptic, maybe what comes to mind is the end of the world, the destruction of all of creation, pits of fire, a big red dragon. But in actuality, the word apocalypse is much more simple than that. It just means to reveal. Revelation. In fact, the root of the word apocalypse is from a phrase that means to take the lid off of. There's a very literal revealing in apocalypse. And so in apocalyptic writing, the goal is to reveal. We would think about revelation as something that happens in the future. But mostly for people who were doing this kind of writing, it's either happening at that moment or it has already happened. The revealing is not a prediction, but rather an interpretation of something that's already occurred. They are telling, through their apocalyptic writing, how it felt to be in this experience. More than just the data and details, but the lived experience of what it means to suffer in this way. Often the event happening in an apocalyptic story is not universal or cosmic in scale, but it's very localized or small. But they're using language and images, vivid images, to tell us it felt as if the world itself had come undone. Apocalyptic writing often includes visions and descriptions of those visions, which is where some of these very distinctive images come from. But for our purposes, if you've tuned me out, apocalyptic writing and the characters within it are intended to express what is inexpressible. Something that happens deep within a person or a community that upends what was expected or known. So now that we kind of get apocalypse, let's think about what a seer is. This title of apocalyptic seer came about sort of in this time of the Second Temple, but seers had existed for a very long time. It's a generic kind of term for a certain type of spiritual person. So we have like prophets, spiritual mediums, and we have seers. And for our intentions of knowing what this is supposed to mean, it's easier to know what seers are not before we get to what they are. So prophets are intended to speak God's words, and usually they receive a calling from God to do that. They don't really get a lot of choice in the matter. That's like half the point of the book of Jonah. And they're required to speak the truth of God, often to a specific community for a specific time frame. Seers, on the other hand, are more like sages, kind of like wise persons, except that they serve in that role in their community after having an encounter or experience with God. And they sought out that divine contact. This is not incidental in their life. It's not by accident. They don't stumble upon God hiding in a cave somewhere. But they prepare themselves spiritually to receive contact with God, sometimes by prayer and fasting. And when they experience this divine contact, they would then serve as beacons in their community, not as teachers in some sort of formal setting, but teachers by example. If you wanted to know how to live a holy life, you would observe the seers in your community. Through observing a seer, you could have their divine knowledge, but without having to go through all the work of spiritual contact with God yourself. One thing about seers is that they are not looking for specific answers to particular questions. It's not an indictment on a particular group or a timeline or a throne. They're seeking contact with the divine. They sought to know what truth itself was, and they are changed and their lives reflected that transformation. So to let us know that these disciples are in fact filling this role in the story, we have to know how to recognize them. If you were writing down a story in the ancient world and you wanted people, readers, to know that these characters are supposed to serve as seers of the apocalypse, then you would fill in this kind of formula. Okay, here's the formula. First, the seer has to interact with God or a divine being, sometimes an angel. Then they have to be afraid and fall to their faces, sometimes at the feet of the person that they're interacting with. Then God has to tell them not to be afraid, and then tell them, get up and go and do whatever particular task it was. This formula might sound familiar to you because we've just encountered it in the text of Matthew 17. We also encountered at another distinct point in the book of Matthew in the last chapter where the resurrection occurs. The women, I think in Matthew's story it's two women, come to the tomb. They speak briefly to the angel as they notice the stone has been rolled away, and then they turn around and there's Jesus. And they, the text says, were filled with fear and fell at his feet. And Jesus tells them, do not be afraid. Rise and go and tell my brothers. So we have these two clear points of disciples of Jesus, followers of Jesus, experiencing and filling this role in the story. After experiencing Jesus in a totally transformed way, at the top of the mountain shining with glory, or in a new and resurrected body. Both times, it changes the lives of those people forever. So to sum it up, an apocalyptic seer is one who serves this role in the story. When experiencing significant change, or having experienced it, they try to communicate something beyond words and to demonstrate what happens with their life when you make divine contact. For us, the role of the disciples in this story is important to notice. These three followers now had a distinct space even within the disciples, because the rest of them don't know what's just happened. They had knowledge that their fellow disciples did not, and they were told not to share this particular vision yet. We saw the question that they asked him as they're coming down the mountain and the somewhat unhelpful answer that Jesus gives them. Jesus said to them, "Don't tell anybody about this vision until after I have died." So this is the secret knowledge of these seers from God, this God they had worshipped all their lives in generations past of their own families, this God who apparently is also the one that they sometimes sleep in a tent with, who they've been following. If they can't tell anybody about this vision, the weight of this moment that they've experienced on the mountain, how are they going to cope? Like the seers, they're told not to share this knowledge, but instead, they were expected to live out of what they had experienced, the transformed Jesus. This is not about prophesying directly what had occurred to them, the truth of God in some succinct and snappy way, but living as if what they had seen was true. The disciples' role is to share this knowledge by action, by living out of Jesus's divine identity, by their own transformation from ordinary followers to seers of the truth. In other places, Jesus impresses upon his disciples that they are to tell of what has happened, to teach. Jesus himself teaches from mountains in the midst of a large crowd in the synagogue. So why is this message, specifically, not supposed to be shared until later? There are lots of reasons you could think of, lots of reasons good scholars have thought of. Some people just kind of leave it as a question mark, which I think is probably a reasonable response. But I think maybe it's rooted in this, as far as I can see. In order to be fully understood and lived out, transformation cannot be taught. It can only be experienced. What these disciples had witnessed, what they had experienced at this moment, would change their life, their belief, their actions forever, but truth is not always easy to express. Instead, Jesus is impressing upon them, allow this knowledge of my transformation to transform you. Then others will know what has occurred. So we ask the question, what is our role in this story? To see ourselves as the disciples, I think, is probably fair. For these three disciples, they're experiencing life in between this moment of transfiguration, but still before Jesus' resurrection. They know now that Jesus is divine, but they don't know all of what he means by his death and return. We're in a similar space. We know about Jesus' resurrection, but we don't yet know all of what it will mean when Jesus returns. They have some knowledge, but not all. We have some knowledge, but not all. So we have to ask, what is it about this divinity of Jesus that changes me? What is different to who I am now that I know who Jesus is than I was before? It's easier in some ways for these disciples because they have a concrete time and moment where they knew in clear vision who Jesus was. And maybe you have that moment too. Maybe you can remember it. The moment where you really grasped even just a speck of the weight of what it meant for Jesus to be God and to be one who knew who you were. Reflecting on this knowledge, this experience of divine contact that we have, what should be different about your life? about our lives before this moment and after. As we become more and more conscious of our experience with a transfigured Jesus, our own transformation from ordinary people to seers of the apocalypse becomes more evident to us and our responsibility within that space. We have been changed because of what God has done, and we teach now not just with words, but with our life, with our example, by living out of the truth of transformation. This includes our conversations with our church communities, who are like James and John and Peter for us, who understand what the weight of that moment means. But it also includes other people, people we have not yet met, those who do not yet know what it means to see Christ transfigured. And for them, we live out of transformation, different than we used to be, because we have to be different, not because being normal or old or whatever is bad, but because we are different than we used to be, even if we don't always feel it, even if we can't always see it. We have been transformed. We have been changed because we have had contact with the divine. You've been listening to me, Pastor Kana Moore, at Hayes Christian Church. Hayes Christian Church is a non-denominational fellowship in Hayes, Kansas. We are supported by the generosity of our members, attenders, and friends. The financial support we raise goes to projects which further spread the gospel to those who do not yet know Jesus, to those local, national, and international missions, and they help keep these podcasts free. If you would like to share a monetary gift with us, please visit our website at hayeschristianchurch.org and click on the donate button. Or you may mail your gift to P.O. Box 1111, Hayes, Kansas 67601. If you have any questions, comments, or would like more information, we would love to hear from you. Simply go to our website and click on the Contact Us form. Thank you for your generosity, and may God bless you as you seek to follow Him.